This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. This afternoon, I've got two widely different interviews. I say that so often, but I always try to find a common thread in them one way or another. Both of them have a lot to do with politics and performing, but the first one more with performing. More with politics, rather. Second one, more with performing. Although we'll find out when I talk to the second author that he has a very wide definition of performing. I'm first going to talk with Wen Huang. He's a Chinese-American journalist, has lived in the United States since 1990, and he's the translator of a fascinating book called The Corpse Walker, Real Life Stories, China from the Bottom Up by Liao Yiwu. Liao Yiwu is one of China's best-known writers. He's been a dissident poet from a very young age, has been arrested frequently, spent 4 years in prison for his outspoken opinions, especially the poetry he wrote after the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. He continues to write, but frequently doesn't get paid for his writing, or his writing gets banned or suppressed in one way or another. So he's currently supporting himself as a street musician, a flute player in southwestern China, mostly in Sichuan province. But he moves around a lot to protect himself and just to see what he can find. One of the things he has found was a lot of what we would call low-life Chinese, people from all sorts of occupations that are not politically or economically or culturally respectable. Just reading through a bit from the table of contents, there's 27 of these in all. The first one is the professional mourner. The second is the human trafficker, the public restroom manager, the corpse walkers. Those are people who have to carry corpses from one area to another. They actually get underneath it and carry it. One new person usually carries it to make it look as if it's walking itself, and the other person leads to make sure the carrier doesn't trip. The leper, the pretend emperor, the abbot, the composer, and then on into the former Red Guard, the counter-revolutionary, the grave robber, the safecracker, the blind arhu player, the street singer, the sleepwalker, and the migrant worker. That's about half of the total of these. They were originally published in Taiwan. A sanitized version was published in the mainland and a larger version in Taiwan. And now Wen Huang has published about half of what were in the original collection. As I say, it's a fascinating view of Chinese life of the sort that you might hear about in political memoirs of one person who got caught up in the Great Leap Forward or the Cultural Revolution or got on the wrong side of the political authorities one way or another. But you don't see so many from so many different points of view. And it's interesting that when Wen Huang was a student in China, his college teacher had him read Studs Terkel's Working to introduce him to American colloquial language, and he obviously mastered that. The translation is very colloquial, But obviously it also connected him with this way of looking at the world. You could say that Liao Yiwu is the Chinese Studs Terkel, except he's so much more than that. In any case, I talked with Wen Huang in New York yesterday, recorded what he had to say, and here is what he had to say. I will tell you that right at the end, I ran out of questions, and the interview stops rather abruptly, but I'll talk a little more after it's over. Who is Liao Yiwu?
Liao Yiwu is a poet and a playwright and a documentary. He is currently living in the southwestern part of China. And we consider Liao as the most censored writer in China because most of his writings are banned in China because he has been documenting the lives of ordinary people who he calls people living in the bottom rung of society.
And he's been in and out of jail and in and out of trouble again and again through his life.
Yes, I would say that since 1989, you know, the landmark event in China when students took to the streets and protested against government and asked for democracy, and that on June 4th, 1989, when the government cracked down on the students, and Liao Yiwu was a poet at that time, and he lived outside Beijing. When he heard the news, he was really, really shaken to the core of what he did, but he couldn't control himself. He wrote a long epic poem called Massacre. And what he did was he recorded the poems, and then with chanting and with some performance art, and then he made that into a tape and then circulated underground to many parts of China. And then the Chinese government, of course, they monitored him and then they arrested him. Since then, he was in jail for 4 years. And in 1994, under international pressure, he was released. And then since then, like you said, he's been in and out of detention, I will say, and he continued his writing career.
And in the Corpse Walker, it says that he's now making his living as a street musician.
Yes, that's he is. He plays flute in the in bars or sometimes and just doing writings in the evenings and just pick up some odd jobs. This whole career thing started in 1994 when he was released from jail, and he suddenly found himself like homeless because his wife left him with their daughter, and a lot of friends and tried to avoid him because it was kind of dangerous to associate with him. So he didn't have a job, and then what he did decide to do is play flute because he learned to play flute from a cellmate when he was in jail, and he just started to hang out with street people. And while he was working on the streets, like playing flute and in the bars, and he got to know a lot of people, he found their lives were so fascinating, and he started to record their lives. And then that's how we call the Corpse Walker stories. Some of the stories were from the people, stories about people who he associated with when he worked on the street as a street musician.
Now, the stories in the Corpse Walker have been published in Chinese in Taiwan, but not on the mainland.
It was published in the mainland. A sanitized version was in... In 2002, what he did was he collected about 60 stories, and with the help of his friends, he used a pseudonym. And then they found a publishing house, because around that time, the Chinese publishing industry was going through reforms, market reforms, and they were really looking for some bestsellers, some books that can help them afloat economically. So he got the works published, but allowed the sanitized, some of the part that's really very critical of the government was removed. And when the book came out in 2002, it immediately, within 2 months, the book became a bestseller. But when the Chinese government leaders, they read some of the books, they were really shocked by what he described in the books about the stories of beggars, about some prostitutes, because for a long time, what communists was trying to do is to bring equality and then to bring a more clean society. And the government leaders, they couldn't accept the fact that those kind of stuff still exist in China. So they actually banned the book. After the book was banned, one of Liao's friends who lived in the United States, he's a lecturer at Yale University specializing in Chinese literature. So he went back to China. He met Liao and heard about this story. He smuggled the manuscript out. Around that time, we don't have the USB drive and stuff like that. He just literally smuggled the manuscript out and then gave them to a publisher in Taiwan. And the full version was published again in 2004. And the current book, Corpse Walker, was partially based on that book. We picked about 16 to 17 stories from the book.
You said that the original version that was published in the People's Republic was sanitized. I can't imagine these interviews being sanitized. There's not a page that is not full of criticism of the government.
They kept some of the parts about the editorial comments about the Chinese government, and then they tried to limit the remarks as harmless as possible. But around that time was pretty radical movement on the Chinese publishing industry, is because people, the whole economic reform, because the economic pressure, they wanted to push the envelope a little bit further, and then they got the books published. But little did they know that immediately after that, and a lot of people who were involved in the projects were fired either from their jobs or they were disciplined in certain ways.
How did you get involved in translating it?
Yeah. What's very interesting, in 2002, I was translating a transcript from Radio Free Asia. As you know, Radio Free Asia is a U.S.-based broadcasting station that broadcasts to China in the Chinese languages. And then the reporter got hold of Liao Yiwu and interviewed him about the banning of the book and also about his life. I just realized that this writer has such a fascinating life. It was very interesting. It would be interesting to introduce him to the American public, because I remember when I was a college student, I read Steph Turkle, the Chicago-based documentarian, Steph Turkle's book, Working. And it was a collection of interviews with ordinary people in Chicago. I found such an enlightening thing for me to do, to understand America, to understand the lives of the ordinary Americans. I felt like Liao's book will probably do the same thing for Americans who really want to know about China. So I just got interested, and I tried to track him down. But since he, as a distant writer, it was very hard for him to stay at one place. He traveled all the time. And so I had no luck finding him. So one time I bumped into a visiting scholar at Harvard University who happened to know him. So when she returned to Beijing, and she got hold of him through a another friend, and then they called me, and that's how I got to know Liao. But we've never met each other, and most of the times we just talk to each other on the phone. And when I had some editorial changes, I would email him or talk to him, and sometimes he would alert me that the phone might be monitored. And we'll start to use some coded words to communicate back and forth. And that's how this book came about.
Now that it has been published in the U.S., though, it's not sanitized at all. Is this going to get him in trouble back in China? Because it's quite clear who did the interviews, and his picture is on the jacket.
I think it will have some impact on his life there. The Chinese government, they won't be happy. But there is one thing. The other thing is the publicity he gets from the United States is actually a protection. In a way, with the international pressure, when his name is more recognizable in the West, and the Chinese government is more cautious in how to deal with him. So in a way, that fame can also be a protection, because there were many incidents in during the past few years when a distant or political writer when they got into trouble, but because of the international pressure, the Chinese government was forced to go through the whole legal procedure rather than just detain him forever. And also, right now, because of the pressure of the Olympics and the Chinese government, they really try to showcase to the world that they are paying attention to human rights. For example, a month ago, the BBC went to Shanghai and requested that they wanted to interview Liao Yiwu. And the public security people, they heard about that. They actually granted him the interview. Originally, they wanted to accompany him to Shanghai, but then in the end, they said, well, we think you will do a good job. And then they sent him there. He was able to conduct the interview. So in a way, the book is, you know, will have some impact. They will start to say, wow, he's this book was banned in China. Now he's published. He's trying to probably tarnish China's image. But on the other hand, it's a protection. They are more cautious when they deal with him. And on the other hand, I think the Chinese government is more relaxed. In 2002, when they banned the book, people just felt like it's such a shameful thing to air dirty laundry. But during the past 7 years, I think things have changed so much. You see a lot of the Chinese language, similar stories on the Chinese internet, and people start to be more and more used to accept the fact this is China. We have the skyscrapers, we have the great economic success stories, but we also have these stories for people who live in the bottom of society. So it's a kind of paradoxical situation.
I found when I've traveled in China that many people were quite willing to criticize the government for, especially for corruption and for taking advantage of their positions to have special economic favors. They're also very critical of the population growth, environmental degradation, and a number of other things. But with the recent furor over the demonstrations in Tibet, it seems that many Chinese are willing to criticize themselves, but when they hear criticism from the outside, they sort of close ranks and they don't want to hear bad things said about their country.
I think it's the kind of a nationalistic feeling, because I think for many years in China, China has this, since the Opium War, the last century when the British colonized China, part of China, and they seem to have a chip on their shoulder. They have this insecurity, national insecurity, thinking that China has been bullied by the Western governments or by the West for many years, and now China is becoming so economically powerful. That's the feeling, that's the nationalistic feeling. It's like it's okay if I criticize the Chinese government, but when it comes from America, people, or from Britain or from the West, people to think that, they are just actually trying to give China a hard time. They feel threatened by China's rise of power. I think it's probably similar feeling here. It's like an American, when I criticize the government here, and then, but when I go back to China, when sometimes people are just becoming too critical of Americans, I start to become defensive too.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the natural thing. But it's also, there is the tendency right now, the younger generation, especially they are the ones who never suffered during the Cultural Revolution or the anti-rightist movement or the different the political campaigns. These are the ones who actually grew up with the rise of China. And there is that, I noticed the nationalist feeling, and almost to the part like the same with the Tibetan issue is very kind of chauvinistic to the part. So it's hard to tell what I think is becoming, or to me, all trace back to the Chinese history, because for the first time China felt like they're powerful enough and they can finally stand up to the Western powers, and it's the national pride in that.
Most of the interviews, though, are with pretty elderly people. There's a lot of what happened during the 50s, during the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, and a lot of the worst excesses that are described in the interviews go back then. He doesn't talk very much, except perhaps with the safecracker and the border crosser and one or two other people like that. He doesn't talk with very many younger Chinese. Do you think the older Chinese are more open to talking about the troubles they had with the government?
I think the reason the book focused a lot on the older folks is because one of the missions that Liao had, he felt like the Chinese history, a lot of people who have gone through the land reform, the anti-rightist movement, they're almost dying out. He felt like part of his book is to record part of the history, what these people have gone through. But then specifically, say who is worried about getting who is worried about criticizing the government. One of the parts, because the reasons that he wanted to interview these older people, because when we were growing up, like I grew up in the late 1960s and the 70s, when we were growing up, the history book we read about the Cultural Revolution and then the anti-rights movement and land reform was totally a different picture. Like, that's when I read the book, it was eye-opening experience for me too. For example, the Great Leap Forward and the famine. We've been told for many years that it was a natural disaster. And even today, on my way to come to New York, somebody told me that just in the Sichuan, in Liao Yiwu's hometown alone, there was speculation that 12 million people died of starvation. And we never heard about these from the government. We never realized it was all the Great Leap Forward when the whole industrialization movement and then Mao initiated, and then all the people went there to produce iron steel in the backyard using that makeshift furnaces, and then it turned out to be a disaster, and nobody took care of the crop, and then there was a disaster, millions of people died. So the very important part of these older people that are willing to talk about it is for the younger generation to actually to learn objectively what the what contemporary Chinese history is. And also, of course, it was easy for the older folks to criticize the government that period, to be more honest about that period, because even the Chinese government have already started to not apologize, but officially said the Cultural Revolution was a mistake, and then there was a mistake made during the anti-rightist movement. And also within China, there's been a movement to uncover the truth during the 1988, the Great Leap Forward, and the famine. So there is the element in there. And I think the main focus that people, Liao, focused on the older folks was part of the preserve, the part of the Chinese history, to defend the history. And in the words for Chinese critics, is basically to tell people what is going on, to uncover what the Chinese government have been covering up for these years.
You left China in 1990. And I guess returned for a couple of years in the late 90s. Did you, either before you left or when you were back there, encounter people like the ones that Liao interviews?
Yes, I do. But the things I never, you know, you take things for granted because everybody went through the period. My parents went through the Great Leap Forward, and I have an uncle who was persecuted during the Cultural Revolution. But you just never notice that. One of the important things I learned from this book is when I went back to China last year after the book was finished, and then I started to notice more people, ask people, just realize amazing that all the people, they have to go through the campaign, because my generation is relatively smooth, that we grew up during the Cultural Revolution, the tail end of the Cultural Revolution, and we were actually lucky enough to benefit from the great economic reforms. I was able to go to the best college in China, and I was able to study abroad and with government sanctions. So, but in the way that I just now notice the people around me, they have these fascinating stories. That's why the book is not only good for foreigners, but also is fascinating for Chinese like me. It was quite a learning experience.
Is there any chance that it will ever be published or allowed in this form into China?
I think so. It's more China. It's more and more. They are more and more laid back about what they're more open about what happened in the past, and there will be certain progress. I think it is possible, but not in the next 2 or 3 years, I think. But the fact that this time when Liao was allowed to be interviewed by the BBC, and it was very encouraging, we were very happy about that.
What is Liao doing now? Is he still a street musician?
Yes, he is. Temporarily, now he's staying with his mother. as you know, like last December, he was awarded by the Independent Chinese Writers Association as for a Freedom to Write Award. And then he went to Beijing to accept the award. But then somehow the police found out, because of this year, the Olympics, they were so sensitive about these student writers gathering in Beijing. So police found him, and then they detained him for 3 hours. And four public security people from his province flew in, and then they all went to eat at a restaurant, and then they took him back. They just left him with his mother, basically just saying, you can write into whatever, just stay away from Beijing, let us have the Olympics, let this thing uninterrupted, and then it's okay. So he's now staying with his mother temporarily.
In Sichuan?
And doing some more writings. He just sent me another piece that a very interesting phenomenon after the economic reform. It's the life of a debt collector. It's a lot of the people who went to collect debts because a lot of the state enterprises are going under, and they couldn't afford to pay them, and then there's a new profession called the debt collector.
They don't collect debts from individuals, but from businesses that have gone under.
From businesses, right.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I was just talking with Wen Huang. Actually, I was talking with him yesterday, and I sort of ran out of questions toward the end. But I think you can tell from the interview that his translation of Liao Yiwu's interviews with lower class Chinese is quite fascinating, quite provocative. I recommend it very highly. It's called The Corpse Walker, Real Life Stories, China from the Bottom Up. There are 27 stories in it, interviews. Each one's a little over 10 pages. And they're very varied. Some of them are brutally unpleasant. Some of them are even somewhat romantic in the picture they have of the raffish side of Chinese society, but all of them are well worth reading. It's called The Corpse Walker, Real Life Stories, China from the Bottom Up by Liao Yiwu, translated by Wen Huang and published by Pantheon Books. I have on the line now Daryl Hickman, an actor that you've probably seen in at least dozens of movies, maybe not always knowing it, because he was quite young when they first began, and then who went on to a stage career, a TV production career, but has spent most of the last few decades teaching acting because of a accident he had that forbade him from continuing acting. He has written a book called The Unconscious Actor, Out of Control in Full Command, and he'll be here this coming Saturday, the 19th, at the Bookseller, and I want to talk to him about this book. So, Daryl, welcome to Booktown.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The book is very different from many other acting treatises, I guess you'd say, in that a full half of it is more or less by autobiography. It's how you acted at different times in your life and what the influences were on you and how you gradually came to develop your own style. How did you start acting?
Well, I was 3.5 years old, and my mother signed me up for Screen Extras Guild, and I was out at the studio at 3.5 saying to Ronald Coleman, and if I were king, alms to the poor. I then went to Paramount and did a film with Bing Crosby. He fell in love with me, apparently. I was about 6 or 7, and I tap danced and sang up a storm with Bing. He sent me to his brother Everett, who was a big agent that we could have never gotten to see. And Everett signed me, and that was the beginning of my career.
And you say that at the beginning, of course, you were too young to exactly know how to act. You just did it.
I was the original unconscious actor because I had no training. I had no formal training in acting until I was on Broadway in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying in the 60s. And up until that time, I had probably the best teachers in the history of the business. Henry Fonda and John Ford and George Cukor and Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. I mean, that's how I learned how to act. I learned how to act by doing it, and watching them and listening to them. It was quite an experience, and I feel very strongly that I've learned from the best there ever was. So I was very lucky.
But you didn't stop there. I mean, even though you learned how to become an unconscious actor, it seems that all your life you've been talking with other actors about acting. You've been reading books about acting. You've gone through several acting fads. I guess especially as you were growing up, method acting was sort of taking over in the United States.
Yes, method acting, which was supposed to be based on the theories of Konstantin Stanislavsky, the great Russian master. Lee Strasberg sort of appropriated Mr. Stanislavsky's ideas, made them his own. He didn't really follow Stanislavsky, I don't think. And then he, you know, had a huge influence on the training of American actors. Most actors in my lifetime were trained in what they called the method, and it has its limitations, what I've been doing now for 30 years is going back to the original Stanislavsky, adding all of the information that I got from the greats that I've worked with and the things that I learned on my own for, you know, 80, 90 movies and all the plays and television shows and stuff. And I've developed a process for, I think, bringing the real Stanislavsky into the 21st century. I think it's the most important thing I've done in my life, and I want to make a contribution, not just to my fellow actors, but to everyone who's interested in performing better in their own lives. So this book is a very important summing up for me, and it's very nice to be able to talk about it.
Well, what is the real difference between Stanislavsky and the people who appropriated his ideas?
It's a great question. The real difference from my standpoint is that Stanislavsky approached the work from a much more spiritual place than an intellectual place. He was a great student of Indian mysticism. He was in trouble with the Soviet government because, as a famous Russian artist, he was writing about spiritual things in terms of drama, and they were trying to keep it quiet. And Mr. Strasberg, as brilliant as he was, and the other teachers, they really could never understand Stanislavsky's references to what Stanislavsky called super consciousness. To me, art and spirituality, or a kind of mysticism, if you will, are very connected. And if we work from the deepest part of ourselves, if we're really creating art, and we're creating from the deepest part of ourselves, we're creating from the imagination and our intuition and the places down there, way inside of ourselves. It's not in the conscious mind. And that, to me, is the huge difference between what Stanislavsky was doing, what I'm updating, really, with my own process, and what the method people were doing for about 80 years.
Now, in a way, you can't blame the method people because they were familiar with his book, An Actor Prepares, but you seem to feel that his other book, Building a Character, is much closer to his full intention, and that wasn't available in this country till after World War II.
That's right, and I must tell you, as big a fan as I am of Stanislavsky, he was not a great writer. He said that himself. He was not very well translated always, and the real essence of Stanislavsky is in his autobiography, My Life and Art. I've worked on both An Actor Prepares and Building a Character, and I can tell you that it's very hard to get what you need as a working actor from those two books. They just, with brilliant ideas, it doesn't add up to what they thought was the system. And so I went to what I consider to be the real Stanislavsky in essence from his autobiography, and I've made his ideas my own ideas and tried to bring them, update them, and bring them into the present day.
Yet you say when you are beginning with actors, there are two other books that you first insist that they all read, and neither of them is Stanislavsky's.
As a matter of fact, I have invited my actors to read My Life and Art, but it's so thick, and it's hard to get through. And I to tell you the truth, If you don't read the right material, it's very easy to get an acting student or any artistic student into their head. And the last thing I want to do is get them hung up on ideas that will hold them in their conscious minds. I'm trying to get them into the deeper part of themselves always. So it's kind of tricky what you give a student to read if you're trying to learn what I'm teaching.
The books you say you do tend to recommend are Eugen Herigel's Zen and the Art of Archery and Ava Ligalian's The Mystic in the Theater.
Oh, yeah. Those are my favorite books about acting. The Eugen Herigel Zen and the Art of Archery was handed to me by a friend of mine. He was a director in New York about the time I was starting to teach my first workshop in New York. And he just handed it to me and said, here's a book I think you'd like. And it became like my primer for my teaching methodology. I wanted to do what that Zen master that Eugen Herigel talks about in Zen and the Art of Archery, I wanted to do for actors what he was doing in training Zen archery. And then also early on, one of my students gave me The Mystic in the Theater, which is the biography of the great Eleonora Duse, the great Russian actress Italian actress who was probably the mother of modern acting, and it coordinated so well with Zen and the Art of Archery because she was coming from a very spiritual place and a place of intuition rather than of intellect, if you will, and so it all kind of came together for me in the beginning based on those two books.
Duse, I guess, was probably the most phenomenal actor anyone who saw her ever saw. Can you tell us a little more? A lot of people these days have probably never heard of her.
Well, when I was a kid in the film business in the 40s and 50s, Duse's name was mentioned with awe in the film business. My mother had seen Duse, and she was highly respected all over the world. The years that I spent at the Actors Studio with Mr. Strasberg, I heard him on more than one occasion say, the greatest actor I ever saw, bar none, was Eleonora Duse. And I asked him once, I said, what was so great about her? And he said, I don't know what she... It was almost like she wasn't doing very much. Her performance would resonate and stay with you for weeks afterwards. And I think it was the transmission of that incredible psychic energy that we all have in us that gets into the audience organically. If we can open our inner selves up and really touch the audience on a real organic level, we reach them in a much deeper place than just their thinking mind. Do you understand?
Very much.
So I think, you know, I saw a snatch of a film at the Museum of Modern History in New York. She did a silent film up there. Some of it that's still extant, and she is incredibly simple and very visual, very physical. She isn't doing a lot of acting. She's being, and being with a capital B.
I took notes on the book, and I'm just staring at them, and some of the ones that jump out at me are, at one point you say that an actor should not try to become a character, and apparently Duse never did that. She somehow just radiated the character.
Yeah, you osmose the ideas from the author. You read the text as many times as you can stand it, and you don't think about it. You just let the ideas that the author is suggesting to you about who you are and who the other people are, and you kind of get it into your bloodstream, and then you let it percolate inside you, and whatever happens inside of you. You don't become somebody else. Spencer Tracy said it brilliantly. He said, I'm Spencer Tracy as the priest. I'm Spencer Tracy as a longshoreman. I'm Spencer Tracy as the sea captain, and that's true of all of us. We give if we're really brilliant character actors, and there aren't many of them around, I'll tell you. We give the sense of being somebody else, but it's always us that has to be on the stage or in front of the camera, and actors try to become somebody else, and they fail because it's not the right way to go about it.
The example that jumped out most strongly at me was that when little kids play, say, cowboys and Indians or cops and robbers, they don't try to be a character. They just are a cop or a robber or a cowboy or an Indian.
That's right, and I was a very successful child actor. I did a lot of movies and a lot of different characters. I was never a star like Shirley Temple, but I was very successful, and I did a lot of different, very difficult roles. And directors always told my mother, don't ever train him, leave him alone. He has a great imagination. He believes. And that's the key. It was the key to my childhood, and it's still the key. I believe what I'm doing, and when I believe it, then it happens properly.
Some of the other notes I have down here are don't try to relax beforehand, and don't try to concentrate. And you mentioned from a number of different actors, and I believe it was Anthony Hopkins who said that he will read a scene maybe 120 times without trying to interpret it in any way, just read it again and again and again till he's completely assimilated it, and that's after that he starts to think about it.
Yes, that's his way of saying that he stays away from the thinking mind, he stays away from his intellect, and he gets into the deepest part of himself. In one phrase I remember, he said, I eat the text, and then I put it away. I just go over and over, and then I put it away. I go to the movies. I think about something else. And then, as I said earlier, it percolates inside, and that's why he's one of the people I use as an example of what I think unconscious acting really is.
And you don't try to concentrate on the role at that time. You don't try to narrow in on it. You just let it become part of you.
Concentration is valuable, I suppose, for some things that we do. But when I try to get my people, and this is true not just in acting, it's true in life. I try to get my people to be 100% aware of what's going on all around them. I call it peripheral awareness, 360 degrees. And I define awareness as the non-judgmental, choiceless observation of what is, so that we're not excluding anything. We're not limiting our focus. We're expanding our focus. Does that make sense?
Very much. But nonetheless, you point out, obviously, that you are doing a script. There are lines. You have to follow the form. And you can't just improvise a role. You can while you're working on it, but in the end you have to speak the playwright's words, and you distinguish between developing a flow and mastering the form.
Exactly. I think the key to performing, not only in acting now and in life, because the subtitle of my book is The Art of Performance in Acting and in Life, I think the same mechanics that we use to create a performance as actors is the same mechanics that we use to create a relationship, to create a career, to create a lifestyle. And what we have to learn to do is we have to get that flow, intuitive flow of emotional energy and images flowing through our voices and our bodies. Then we go to the other side of the brain. That's the right side of the brain. Excuse me. And then we go to the other side of the brain, the thinking part of ourselves, and we create a structure which gives the whatever it is we're going to do, whatever it is we're going to perform, an architecture, if you will, and then that energy, then we put it out of our minds, our thinking minds, we open the gate of all of that intuitive flowing energy, psychic energy, emotional energy, imaginative energy, and we let it flow through the form, and it animates the form moment to moment in performance. If you do it right, this is my process, if you do it right, the performance is always new, and it's always for the first time. The structure remains the same. I call that form. But the flow is constantly changing because our intuitional self is constantly changing. So it's flow through form, moment to moment, always discovering the performance.
You mentioned Eugen Herigel, and in the text of the book, you mentioned having read and being totally, I guess you'd say, transformed by reading Krishnamurti. In your biography, you not only mentioned those two, but also people like Jane Roberts, Eckhart Tolle, Ken Wilber, and so on. These clearly represent the metaphysical, your metaphysical interest. How, you've said a little bit about how that fits into acting, but can you say a little more?
Well, you see, I must admit, I'm prejudiced because I believe life is much more of a spiritual journey than some of us see it as. I have always been very, it's always been very important to me to find the deepest meaning in not just in acting or in the drama business, but in my life and in my relationships. I believe that we all have a relationship with the creative force. You can call it God, you can call it source, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but we have a connection to the most awesome kind of energy. And if we can get our egos out of the way and open ourselves to this energy that is available to us from the universe, if you will, we can accomplish anything. We can create anything. We can do anything that we decide that we want to do if we learn how to put it all together. So that, to me, is the beginning of everything, the spiritual aspect of man. That's what makes us different from, you know, the animals and the plants, which are full of life but a different kind of energy. That's all.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking right now with Daryl Hickman, author of The Unconscious Actor, Out of Control, In Full Command. You're going to be in Grass Valley this coming weekend. How did that come about?
Well, a former student of mine, Karen Lee Sharp, has been teaching her version of my process up there, and she's put this all together for me. She's a wonderful lady. And I'm going to do a seminar, and then on Saturday at 3 p.m. at the bookseller, I'm going to sign books and talk about why I think this is an important book, not just for actors, but for anybody who wants to perform better in their lives. So it's the bookseller on Mill Street in Grass Valley. It's 3 o'clock. It's free. But as she says, the seating is limited, so, you know, you should come, you should make reservations or be sure you get there on time.
And I walked in here and just noticed that I left Karen's email at home. I do have it here on my computer. Or do you have it in front of you?
I don't think I have the email. I have the flyer. Why do you ask?
Oh, I'm just... If people want to get in touch with her about the workshop, I guess the best thing to do right now is probably call the bookseller at...
I have her phone number.
Oh, her here. Phone number. Give us your phone number.
Let me give you the phone number. It's Karen Lee Sharp at 530-292-1626. And if people are interested in getting the book or seeing the book and they can't come to the bookseller at 3 o'clock on Saturday, they can always go to my website, darylhickman.net, darylhickman.net. You can order the book through my website, or you can order it from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, whatever. So I'd love to see anybody that's interested come at 3 o'clock on Saturday. I'd love to see them.
And can you give us Karen's phone number one more time?
Karen's phone number is 530-292- 1626.
Okay, that is Daryl Hickman, who will be here on Saturday in those two different ways. You can see him in the workshop and at the bookseller at 3 p.m. The book is called The Unconscious Actor, Out of Control, In Full Command. And unfortunately, I'm going to be working at 3 p.m. I may see if I can just run up and stick my head in, but
I probably won't
fit in.
Do. We'll make room for you. Please come. I'd love to meet you.
Okay. Thanks so much for being with us, Daryl.
Take care. My pleasure.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking in the first half of the program about The Corpse Walker, Real Life Stories, China from the Bottom Up by Liao Yi Wu, translated by Wen Huang, and just now with Daryl Hickman about his book, The Unconscious Actor, Out of Control, in Full Command. And I hope you caught Karen Lee Sharp's phone number, because I didn't write it down, unfortunately, but you can always call the bookseller if you didn't get it. That's 272-2131, or show up at the bookseller at 3 p.m. on Saturday to see Daryl Hickman. And as we said, seating is going to be quite limited there, and there'll probably be a lot of people. A couple of other events happening in this upcoming week. The Nevada County Poetry Series is having this month's program. It's going to feature Frank Andrick and Artie Armstrong, Frank Andrick and Artie Armstrong at the Off-Center Stage at the Center for the Arts. That's 7:30 p.m. this Thursday, 7:30 p.m. this Saturday. And for more information, you can call 432-8196. And the other poetry event that's happening on Saturday is in celebration of National Poetry Month. There's going to be a three-hour open mic at Coffee Town at 134 South Auburn Street in Grass Valley. That is free, and anyone who wants can show up and read any time in that period from 4 to 7. Who knows, they might even continue longer if there's that many people. If you want more information about the National Poetry Month open mic, call 263-3627. If you want more information about the Nevada County Poetry Series reading of Frank Andrick and Artie Armstrong, which is Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at the Off-Center Stage of the Center for the Arts, call 432-8196. And this has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm about to get out of here. Jimmy Accardi's coming right up with his rock and roll party.